Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I am your host, Matt Smith, and this is episode, wait for it, CXXVII, Augustus, the Making of an Emperor, live at the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne. A few thanks before we get started today. Thank you to the School of Humanities and Social Sciences at La Trobe University for encouraging, nay, treasuring us and supporting this live show tonight. Thanks to the Wheeler Centre for their help and for their fine venue here. Thanks to the traditional landowners, the Wurundjeri people on whose land we stand today. And thanks to all of you for braving this lovely Melbourne weather, which is not toga-friendly, trust me. And on that note... Tell your men to drop their swords, Sulla. Tell your men to drop their swords, Sulla. Friends, Melburnians, countrymen, how nice that you have all joined me here tonight as we celebrate the birthday of the ostentatious Emperor Augustus. While he'll always be the first emperor in our hearts, he wasn't always destined to be. A man of the right birth, to be sure, but it took skill and it took a bit of luck to build the mighty empire that he did. To take us through the wonderfulness that is the early years of Octavian, it is my honor, nay, my privilege, no wait, my pleasure, to introduce you to a scholar trained by scholars. I first encountered her in the ruins of the Roman Forum itself, praying at the Temple of Vesta to guide her hands to the lost work by Domitian, Care of the Hair. Since then, she has taught us about the wonders of the Roman past, how to mind both our V's and our U's, and to correct every bit of Latin that has come out of my mouth in the past 6 years. I give to you an associate professor in the School of Classical Studies at La Trobe University. She'll make you take your clothes off and go dancing in the Rhine. Please help me welcome, but do not establish eye contact with, Associate Professor Rhiannon Evans.
So many mistakes. All right, first of all, and maybe I should have said this two live shows ago, when we've got all these people here, avete, not ave.
Yeah, 6 years too late,
yeah, well.
Honestly.
It's okay, we'll muddle through.
So, tonight we are here to celebrate Augustus. Happy birthday to the big Augie himself.
Yeah.
How many years is it? You tried to count it, but
I did.
There's inclusivity, and then there's Gregorian crap going on.
I did it and I didn't write it down, did I? I did it again today with my Latin students and they corrected me. There's no year zero, so 2018 years, plus 63. Well, the Romans counted inclusively, but not for ages, I suppose. I mean, my math still isn't good enough.
Okay.
It's 2018 plus 63. You can do your own maths.
When and why was this era that he was born and he was growing up? When and why?
When and why?
Just when. Tell me about Rome during the time that Augustus was young.
Okay, well, it's kind of falling apart, isn't it? 63 BC, momentous year. Cicero is consul.
Yeah. Shout out to my man Cicero.
he's not going to last long. He's dealing with a conspiracy, a Catilinarian conspiracy, and some would see this as part of the conflict, in fact, I think justifiably, part of the conflict that Augustus, or Octavian, we're going to call him, will deal with, which is all kinds of conflict between the orders in Rome, so between the Senate and the people, very broadly speaking.
So the last legs of the Roman Republic, it's all happening around now.
Yes, exactly. And in a way, he will be the one to benefit from that, because the reason that we all know Julius Caesar, not the first emperor, none of us will make that mistake. None of my students will ever make it again. That he is the first emperor is because he's the one who successfully deals with that conflict, that internal conflict that starts so many civil wars in Rome, where you have the senatorial faction, as it were, wanting to protect the rights of the Senate, this little gang of oligarchic families that runs Rome, in the Republic, and he'll turn it into something that he claims is giving more power to the people and power back to the Senate, but is in fact one man in charge, an emperor.
So who was Octavian then, and how did he manage to get close enough to Julius Caesar to be his heir?
Okay, well, he's the great-nephew of Julius Caesar, but he's not born Octavian. He's born Gaius Octavius. That's his dad's name. Mm-hmm. And it's a plebeian family.
So junior, the younger.
You know that the Romans very unimaginative with names.
Just winding you up.
Indeed. And his father is, although he's from the plebeian ranks, that's increasingly not meaning as much by the late Republic. He is very well regarded, apparently was on course to be consul, although he dies when Octavian, at the time Octavius, is four. Mm. In a way, it doesn't really matter, and in fact some would say it helps him, because his mother is so well connected. It's from his mother's side. His mother is Julia, the sister of Julius Caesar. So that's where he gets the connection to Julius Caesar. And it's Julius Caesar's family, a patrician family, so extremely elite. You can't be more elite. Mm. And it must mean that Gaius Octavius, the father, was very well regarded to be admitted into this family, as it were, by marriage.
Right. And so as he's growing up, I guess lacking a father figure, Julius Caesar is around and sufficiently powerful enough to kind of guide things a little bit. I mean, 5 years or so after he's born, you've got the Gallic Wars, and then there's associated triumphs happening.
Yeah, Julius Caesar is not really around.
No,
he's off
clearly.
In Gaul.
Yeah, yeah.
It's true, Caesar's consul in 59, which I guess is the year of Octavian's father's death, but then he is in Gaul pretty much all through the 50s. So while he's not around, he's still a good connection for him to have. So, for example, when Octavian is 14, he gets to give the funeral oration of his great-aunt Julia, Julius Caesar's sister. And that this is, he's 14 years old. He's not yet considered an adult.
Yeah.
So this is kind of amazing. This is putting him on a public platform where, you know, would you trust most 14-year-olds? Not to do the youth down, but it's a huge honour for him. Mm. And I guess he's allowed to do it because his father's dead and he's kind of the most significant male there at the time. And he's clearly being fostered for some kind of high position by Caesar and the family.
When somebody important comes to some sort of prominence in this, in all the sources there are portents and signs, even if they're kind of designated in retrospect. My favourite one is Septimius Severus. No, Pertinax becoming emperor because a horse fell off a roof.
Yeah.
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 So was there anything...
Got to make sure that happens when you're nearby so that you'll become emperor.
Was there plummeting equines for Augustus?
No. I've just realised we haven't mentioned his mother's name, which is really bad.
Oh.
She's called Artia.
Okay.
When Artia gives birth to Octavius, as he is at the time... there's a whole list of these in Suetonius, of course, and also in the Greek historian Dio Cassius. But my favourite one refers back to Octavian's father. So Dio Cassius says that this prophet and senator Nigidius said, "You have fathered a master over us," to Octavian's father. At this, Octavius was alarmed and wished to kill the child. It was a bit of an extreme reaction. Could have been all over there. But Nigidius stopped him, saying that it was impossible for it to be destroyed. This child cannot be destroyed. He's immortal. He's indestructible.
You know, I've got to wonder about that, because you fathered a master over us, and if you're gung-ho about the Roman Republic and a staunch Republican, you might go, yeah, we don't want that sort of thing.
Exactly. It's exactly the kind of thing that will be told afterwards, because everybody knows he's going to be, you know, he did become the master over us. So it's very easy to say in retrospect. And of course, yes, people reading that who still cherish the power of the Senate would read it exactly the way that you suggest, that this was a negative and maybe Octavius should have manned up and got rid of him.
So he has a kind of fast initiation / rise through the ranks of Roman society from that point?
Yes. We know very little about the childhood apart from that funeral oration. But he clearly is being groomed for public life by the stage where he gets that transition into adulthood. So by 46 BCE, which is when Caesar's coming back to Rome, He's been groomed for public life. So he takes part in Caesar's triumph over Africa. So he's getting marched there in this very public scenario, which is kind of the high point of Roman social life in a way and political life. And then he's sent to Spain the following year to take part in the Spanish War, although probably not take part in it. He's still very young. And in fact, he gets shipwrecked and has to travel back with just a few companions. But that impresses Julius Caesar, the fact that he does manage to get back. So he doesn't really see any military action while Caesar's still alive, but what he does is something that looks good, and Caesar is impressed enough to write him into that will.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, Caesar is, you know, dead quite soon, spoiler alert.
Oh, no, don't tell people.
But he had recently made Octavian his heir.
Yes, he had. He had made him his heir and adopted him in his will. Mm. Now, he could have adopted him while he was alive. So you can have all kinds of conspiracy theories about why it worked out like that. That's quite unusual. In fact, the Senate had to approve that later on.
Sort of like the afterthought kind of thing, aspect of it.
You could read it like that, couldn't you? Was he hoping something else would come along? But that never gets mentioned in any kind of Augustan propaganda. Yes, so it's happening sort of quite late. Caesar doesn't think it's quite late on in his life. But he makes him his heir, and he also makes him a patrician. So this gives him, it's kind of symbolic status, but it is symbolic status. In a way, this will work against him later on because he'll desperately want a power that's only available to plebeians, but it won't stop him getting it, don't worry.
Mm.
So yes, he's kind of raised in the public gaze again by Julius Caesar's death.
But is he also kind of given things that weren't Caesar's to give away?
Well, it's what you take from that, the kind of power that you take from it, is it's sort of up for grabs. I mean, he gets the name Julius Caesar, and that was Caesar's to give. He's only 18 years old, and he wants to give all of the money that Caesar has given away as you know, in his will. Mark Antony's taking charge of the will. If you're for Octavian stroke Augustus here, then you have to start hissing every time Mark Antony appears today because he's trying to block Octavian at every move here. And so he just kind of grabs money along the way and gives it out as these sort of benefactions that were written into the will.
Mm.
But very shortly after that, he wants to have political magistracies. Now, if you've done the maths and you remember that Caesar is murdered in 44, then Octavian is, and he is called Octavian now, he is still just 18 years old. So he's not allowed to have any magistracies, let alone the ones he's asking for. He's much, much too young. But he starts capitalizing on this name that he's got. He does things like organize the Julian Victory Games. So let's get the name Julius in there, which is now part of his name, because he is now Gaius Julius Caesar Octavian. We're calling him Octavian, which he would hate. He never called himself Octavian. He called himself Caesar. But that's confusing, so we tend to call him Octavian.
Too many Caesars going
around.
Yeah,
exactly.
He's also very clever to kind of make alliances, the right alliances, and kind of keep them just for as long as they're useful, which I suppose we'll get into a bit later.
Yes.
But he gets Rome on his side very quickly, mostly using Caesar's name.
Exactly. Caesar's name is all important, and also the fact that at Caesar's... at those Julian games, the comet is seen and it's declared to be Julius Caesar's soul going up to the stars and he's now a god. Therefore, Octavian can call himself the son of a god, and that's great propaganda, and he puts it on coins. All right, so he's got all of this going for him. It doesn't, by the way, mean automatic respect, as we'll see. He still has to work for some of that. But one of the ways he works at is by being pragmatic. Octavian is nothing if not pragmatic. He will do the thing that helps him to get a leg up. So this early hostility between him and Mark Antony has to be managed.
Mm.
And in a way, what he does there is something that, if you only know the broad brushstrokes of what happens, i.e. Octavian will sort of banish the power of the Senate, despite the way he presents it eventually. He sort of makes a deal with the Senate. He goes in, and he's encouraged to do this by people like Cicero. Cicero is really encouraging Octavian at this point.
He calls him a divine youth.
The divine youth, I
know. I don't
know
if that's Cicero's sarcasm, though.
No, I think he really thinks...
Really?
He really thinks that at least that he can, and he and the Senate can make use of Octavian.
Mm.
All right, that he's got this kind of resonance about his name, but he's very young and inexperienced. So we'll sort of guide him through and use him, and we'll use him against Antony because Cicero bitterly hates Antony. So
Cicero wrote 8 books about how much he hates Antony.
yeah, it's lengthy. Lengthy, his hatred.
It's like a Comedy Central roast. It's brutal.
It is a roasting. It's exactly that, yeah. One of these days we'll do some podcasts on that. Antony's been consul in 44. He's meant to get a province the following year. That's kind of the rules. But Cicero and other senators want to stop him, and they use Octavian to stop him and to keep this is the province of Cisalpine Gaul, northern Italy, basically. The man who's actually got the province at that time is one of Caesar's murderers, Decimus Brutus. Mm. So Antony goes up there to kick him out, and the Senate, Cicero, use Octavian and send him up there with the consuls of that year to stop that happening. So they give him an army. He's 18 years old and they give him an army.
Yeah.
This doesn't sound like a good thing to do. They put him in charge of an army. You think, how foolish were they to give him that much power at that age? And it really it does backfire on them, because then when there's this negotiation that we can't really go into, but basically Antony sort of backs off slightly and so it's resolved. And then the Senate asks for the army back, and Octavian says, no, I'm not getting that army back. So now he's got an army.
See, at that point, the only followers he should have are on Instagram.
Yeah, that would be dangerous enough.
So we're fast approaching now, though, where he kind of...
He does a backflip.
Yeah, he stops being used by the Senate. So I kind of wonder how much he was being used or going along with it. But, you know, he's 18.
There are big arguments about that. And then similarly about how much Cicero thought that he was fostering this wonderful youth or using him.
Mm.
Either way, it doesn't work out well for Cicero.
So he becomes friends with Antony.
Well, he makes
A bit, friend's a bit too strong a word, but you know.
He makes a deal with Antony.
Yes.
And it is, again, very pragmatic move, because the murderers of Caesar, the kind of prime murderers, Brutus and Cassius, are still to be got. All right, they haven't been brought back. They've fled. They need to be brought back. Antony, along with another guy called Lepidus, who was one of Caesar's allies, have 17 legions between them, and Octavian can't really challenge that.
Mm.
And he knows that that kind of army could help him get the assassins of Caesar, and he wants to deal with that. So he makes an alliance with Antony and Lepidus, and they call it the Second Triumvirate, which means the Gang of Three. They're often called the Three in studies, when ancient historians talk about them, they talk about the Three. And we call it the Second Triumvirate because there had been one that Julius Caesar was involved in.
Because it's a tribute act to Julius
Caesar.
Yeah,
well, that one wasn't official. This one
is an official tribute act.
This is the first one was a secret triumvirate. This one is legitimized in as much as something like this can be by the Senate. But, you know, really, this doesn't work with the Republican Constitution.
But are they basically dictators then?
Yeah, they get the power. They get absolute power.
Mm.
And this is passed through the Senate. Basically, they have the position of dictators to do whatever they want. And the pact is that they will go and get the murderers of Caesar. They'll engage them in battle, which they do. They defeat them in 42 at Philippi.
Mm.
And in exchange, Octavian has to agree to certain things like killing a lot of Romans. The prescription lists, and Cicero is the victim of this prescription list amongst a lot of other Romans.
Yeah, yeah. And but the reason he kind of does that doesn't seem to be mostly his doing. Is he going along with things at that stage?
He's going along with what he needs to get these people to back him up in his great kind of vengeance against Caesar's murderers. Because something that's very important to him is to be seen as doing his filial duty. He will make the most of that later.
Yes.
And a big part of that is killing the people who killed his father.
And throwing Brutus's head at the foot of a statue of Caesar.
We're coming to that at the
end.
In our list of nasty things that Octavian does.
Okay.
We've got a big list at the end.
Sorry, okay.
He does, though. It's pretty awful throwing... he is an assassin. But throwing
Rhiannon,
his...
we've got that in the list later
okay,
on. Can you just kind of
ignore
that
now.
I even said that and wonder at my skillful editing later on? When
it's worth saying twice because it's so nasty, actually.
And apparently we will. Yeah. So they carve up the empire then.
Then there are power struggles. So the way they deal with it is Octavian gets, in very broad terms, the West, and Antony gets the East, including Egypt. Things will happen there.
And Lepidus gets left out?
He initially gets Africa, but Octavian will just take that from him at some point. And it's probable that, a bit like Cicero thought that he could use Octavian, young and inexperienced, Antony probably thought that he'd got the good deal here, because the East is very rich and wealthy. He can get a lot of resources there.
And Egypt's kind of where you get a lot of food from.
Yeah,
so.
It's so wealthy. Whereas Italy is kind of in a bit of a shambles because there have been civil wars. He, as part of the deal with getting Italy, he's got to settle all these veterans.
Mm.
So it's a big job to take on. And Antony thinks, well, I've got out of that one. I've shoved it onto Octavian. But in fact, later on, when Octavian has done that job, he has all these people feeling some kind of respect for and therefore feeling bound to him. And he can say, I had Italy behind me. And in a way, he's right. He put in the hard yards.
So he improves Italy and he consolidates his power.
Absolutely.
So that's pretty good.
Yeah, it's pretty clever. Maybe he lucks out, but he's playing the long game, it looks like.
Mm. So civil war is over from that point, all good?
For a little bit.
For a little bit. So... meanwhile, you've got Antony down in Egypt going native.
That's a very crude way of putting it, but that's the way he's certainly represented in our sources.
Just for the record, the quotation figures didn't, that's not Cleopatra or anything. But, he's enjoying himself down there to the point where his critics say he's less Roman and more Egyptian.
They will get away with saying that because, of course, he'll be the loser in the end.
Yes.
But, yes, that's the way it can be billed.
Mm.
He talks of prosecuting a war against Parthia. That doesn't really come to anything. So this second triumvirate is renewed in 37 BCE, but pretty soon after that, and it's clear that Antony is not coming back in a way, that he's going to marry, he marries Cleopatra, for whom he leaves Octavian's sister. So that's not a good look for this pact staying together. And he starts, there's this, in 34, there's something called the Donations of Alexandria, where he starts giving her bits of the Roman Empire, to put it in crude terms, which, again, doesn't look good back in Rome. So this kind of spells the end of the alliance, and really we're building up to a final civil war, which won't be billed as a civil war by Octavian. He'll play that very cleverly too.
Well, how does he play it?
War against Egypt, of
course. War against Egypt, okay.
Yeah.
And Egypt is pretty much a good pickings to have, essentially, because you've got Cleopatra, who you can build up as an enemy, harboring an enemy. She's a woman, come on.
Yeah, a woman in charge is also something that, from the Roman point of view, you can build as strange and exotic and weird. She's a queen and, Rome doesn't have kings and queens. They got rid of that. And Antony, there are rumours that he's going to take the capital to Alexandria, that he's being un-Roman because of this, that he's being ruled by a woman. So there's all of this going on, all of these rumours and ways of talking about Antony that don't make him look like a good Roman man.
Mm. And at this point, Octavian still?
Yeah.
Yeah, Octavian still. Makes another good choice, which is becoming good friends with Agrippa.
This is something that is very fortunate for him throughout his career, that quite often ancient historians will talk about Octavian on the battlefield as not being very efficient.
No, we didn't
useful.
Say it before, but Battle of Philippi, he kind of becomes sick and stays in his tent.
He he doesn't have a good reputation on the battlefield, but he kind of manages to cover it up by delegating. That's probably a very cynical view of Octavian, but it is the way that it's told in some of our histories. And so Agrippa is a great ally for him, and he'll be really important in the final battle against Antony and Cleopatra. And indeed, along the way, he's also, throughout the 30s, there's this kind of ongoing war with the son of Julius Caesar's civil war enemy. So we've got whole dynasties of enmity going on here through the generations. Yeah, Sextus Pompey. And Agrippa is really the person who finally deals with that in the Mediterranean. But, of course, Octavian can claim victory over that because he's nominally the one in charge. So he's got all of these useful allies. He picks his friends well and he delegates well. So that's a strength as well, and this is good for him when it comes to that final conflict. Clearly, by 32 BCE, there's going to be a war between Octavian and Antony. 300 senators, in fact, leave Rome at the start of the year and join Antony. So
that's a lot of them.
Yeah, not all of the Senate is behind Octavian.
That's most of them that aren't, I think, probably at the time.
Well, yeah, and there's a bit of back and forth going on, but this is a civil war for all that Octavian will bill it differently later. Octavian then gets declarations of war from the residual Senate against Cleopatra, very definitely against her. He says that, and he tells us this, we've got this kind of magnificent epitaph that he wrote before he died by Octavian, where he kind of retells the history in ways that look good for him. It's quite a long epitaph. It's called the Achievements of the Divine Augustus. Which is a great... he wrote a memoir as well, which we don't have, but we do have this epitaph. And he says that he had all of Italy behind him and he called on what he calls a consensus of everybody. So he makes it look like it's just this kind of aberrant band that's out there with Antony, and he has Italy, he has the kind of sort of center of empire behind him. He makes a lot of this. So the Western provinces give him this oath of allegiance, according to him, and they demand him as the leader of the war. So by this point, he's a little bit older, but he's basically in his early 30s.
Yeah.
Still not at the point where you tend to be leading an army, but he's already been doing that for a decade or so.
So by getting rid of Antony, he's going to get rid of his last, probably greatest rival at this point.
Mm.
So do you think that it was always aspirations of greatness that made him do this? Because it's hard to imagine that at this point being an emperor is his end game or what he's aiming for. But it's very hard to kind of know.
Well, I guess we have to think briefly, I promise it'll be brief, about this in context. In that Julius Caesar, you could argue, had been aiming for that. He had made himself perpetual dictator. He had sort of tried to end this conflict that had been going on between those who wanted to preserve things exactly as they were, with the Senate firmly in charge, and those who wanted to do things slightly differently, with one person potentially in charge. But you could see that as a failed way of resolving that because he was murdered.
Mm.
All right, so that didn't really work. That didn't resolve the tension. So I think that being very aware of that, Octavian has to find another way through this dilemma. And one way is to initially make this pact with Antony, but then it's obviously not going to last forever. I mean, it starts very badly. It starts with hostility. And really, Antony plays into his hands by letting him keep Italy there, by letting him be in charge in Italy, so that when it all starts to fall apart again, when they come to this inevitable conflict, he looks like he's the outsider.
Mm.
So he doesn't play a good game here, although it's easy for me to say.
Well, Antony also doesn't
benefit a lot of hindsight.
Antony also doesn't make it all that easy for him to appear as anything but a bit of a traitor, really, when he's... like somebody's turning his back on Rome.
Yeah, I think it's very, very hard for us to say that, because if Antony and Cleopatra had won the Battle of Actium, you can bet we'd have a completely different version of this.
We'd have a completely different podcast series, I'm sure. So, Octavian wins the Battle of Actium.
With a lot of help from Agrippa.
Yeah, sorry. Octavian is seasick in his cabin. No, honestly, he is seasick in his cabin. So we can't be good at everything. So then he pursues Antony and Cleopatra to Alexandria. I seem to take a lot of reading about the Battle of Actium as being more so that Cleopatra and Antony were so bad at waging war here, that they made so many wrong decisions, and that a woman went along, you know.
Who are you reading?
Suetonius.
Okay, well, it's not at all biased. Yeah, I mean, it looks like Antony and Cleopatra panicked from the accounts we had, and they maybe should have stuck there and fought it out, but they didn't. So they lose that war. They both kill themselves.
They do.
Unless you believe the conspiracy theories, we won't talk about that now. And
what, they're in Las Vegas doing weddings or something?
That'd be great, wouldn't it? No, that Octavian gets rid of them. He gets rid of lots of other people after all.
He does.
But this gives him sort of leeway to go back to Rome. He goes back in 29 and celebrates a triple triumph over a war that we haven't actually mentioned, that he was pursuing in Dalmatia, so approximately
Illyria.
Croatia. Actium.
Yes.
He says triumph over Actium and over Egypt. Although I think he's double dipping there a bit. Actium's part of the victory over Egypt, surely.
But what's a triple triumph? You know, what's that? How can you have a celebration that's bigger than the biggest celebration? Three times bigger.
Well,
three times as many elephants.
No, you see, Caesar had already had a quadruple triumph. So in a way, he's saying, I'm not quite as good as Julius Caesar.
How do you have a triumph that is four times as great as the greatest celebration ever? You know, it's not like, he has 79 golden camels.
You just have four lots of captives, and I guess it lasts a very long time, and you spend a lot of money on the people giving them entertainments. So
that sounds exhausting.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it, just talking about it. What this means for Octavian is that Egypt has basically become his personal province. That's the way he uses it. He never puts a senator in charge of Egypt.
Mm.
All right, he kind of has direct control there and puts someone slightly less powerful in charge. And they answer to Octavian. And, of course, as we've mentioned, is very, very wealthy. And whenever Octavian needs it, he can just reach into Egypt and feed Rome with the grain. Get money from there, whatever he needs. It's a great resource for him. It's a very rich province.
Okay, so let's kind of sour it a bit and talk about how ruthless he was, which was a key to his success.
Yeah, well, you know, I think part of this is the way, before we get onto our big list of it, the way that he whitewashes that Egypt campaign. I think this is an aspect of his ruthlessness. So I just want to briefly read a quote from the Achievements of Augustus, where about Actium, Octavian says, the whole of Italy voluntarily took an oath of allegiance to me and demanded me as its leader in the war in which I was victorious at Actium.
That's it.
He doesn't mention Egypt. He never mentions Antony. Certainly never mentions Cleopatra either. So that's it. So it's all about Italy and me. It's a real whitewash. So part of that ruthlessness is about... And then he says, Egypt I added to the empire of the Roman people a bit later. Good for him. But how he did it, the fact that he had to pursue a war, against a Roman general in order to do that, you never hear it. If we didn't know it from other sources, maybe we wouldn't know. And I think this whitewashing, I mean, all politicians do it. He's just very good at it.
Yeah. He's essentially deleting his old tweets.
Yeah. Yeah, but then nobody's taken a screenshot. Well, I guess they have. I guess they have, because we do have other accounts.
Yeah, we've got Suetonius. Suetonius was there going, you know, control C, control V, control C, control V. He was on it, my man. All right. Ruthlessness. Let's go. Big list.
You want the list. A lot of this is from Suetonius, but... Well, something I've already mentioned is that proscriptions list.
Yes.
Agreeing to that so that he could get the second triumvirate, so that he could get that army to back him and get Caesar's murderers.
But to extrapolate it, prescriptions was, let's kill all these people.
Yeah, it's a basically legitimised murder.
Including
Cicero, as we mentioned.
Cicero, hands nailed to the door, Cicero.
His hands and head were cut off.
Yeah.
And put on the speaker's rostrum, so the platform where he had given so many speeches.
I feel that was Mark Antony's doing, you know.
Yes.
Where's your ninth book, Cicero? Ah, I can't write it now. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, no, we know that Antony was behind him being put on that list.
Yeah.
Also, after so much to say that we haven't even mentioned a whole war that happened in the 30s called the Perusine War, which is where Octavian defeated Antony's wife, Yes, Antony's wife was involved in this war around Perugia, Fulvia, and Antony's brother, Lucius. And after that war, Octavian sacrificed 300 senators at the altar of Julius Caesar. So this is human sacrifice, which is very strange because the Romans believe that barbarous people commit human sacrifice and that they might have done it sometime in the past, but it's a long time in the past and things were different then and it was in a time of crisis. So this looks like revenge and it's kind of highly ritualized vengeance.
There's also Romans that they're doing this to.
It's Romans that they're doing it to. He's putting it into this very weird religious context with this... this strange thing where a man has now become a god, which also is a bit of an innovation at Rome, or certainly of historical figures. So all of this is very strange and extremely cruel, I would say.
Mm.
Suetonius's big list, we can go through. This is his big list of Suetonius. I mean, overall, I would say Suetonius ends up being a fan of Augustus.
Oh, yeah.
But he sort of starts out by saying that he has this, as a youth, in many ways, you wouldn't have expected him to be a great character, and he doesn't have very high moral code. So he's an adulterer, for example. It's not even something I've put down here because it's not really about ruthlessness, but Suetonius talks about that. So there are rumors that he has engaged torture and killed a soldier who's been led to an angry crowd of soldiers massing to kill him. Luckily, the soldier appears alive just in time, and even then, the person who's been accused of this is nearly caught by a band of marauding gladiators, all right? So these rumors circulating nearly do for him. Also, rumors that he hires basically contract assassins to kill Decimus Brutus. So remember I said he's one of the assassins of Caesar, but he's got this province in northern Italy, the one that Mark Antony's trying to get his hands on. Well, did Octavian try to kind of cut through all of this by just getting a brutal assassin to go up there and get rid of Brutus? Apparently the plot was discovered, so he just bribes some veterans of Caesar's army to protect him. So we can imagine that, and in a way it's sort of more entertaining, I suppose, if some of this is true, that it was actually kind of lots of life and death risky situations going on for Octavian in those early years, that he was kind of getting through by the skin of his teeth, that he had to make sure that he had some kind of protection around him at all times. There's also a suggestion that at that same moment, in the war the battle against Decimus Brutus or against Antony, both of the consuls of that year died. We know that happened, both the consuls of 43.
Dodgy circumstances.
The rumour is that Octavian had a hand in that, that was actually quite useful to him because he wanted to be consul, and he will get that shortly afterwards. He also does nasty things like insulting captives, as Suetonius says, even elite captives, even well-born ones. He tells them things like the birds will pick their corpses. Really nasty one. He makes a father and son who are captives draw lots to see which one of them will die. But both of them are killed anyway. All right, so this is like the behavior of the worst emperors that we've gone through at length in these podcasts. It's the kind of nasty, malicious stuff that happens.
Then again, you know, if it wasn't for the 40 years of mostly good stuff, we wouldn't even be discussing this, I suppose.
I guess not.
He mellows out once he wins.
Well, some would say that you still don't want to get on the wrong side of him. You don't want to be a danger to him. And I suppose that if you're prepared to accept that he is the emperor and he's in power, if you make that deal with Octavian, or Augustus as he becomes then that will be okay. But if you challenge him, even just by being the wrong kind of person, then you're probably in trouble. I mean, he does exile members of his own family later on.
Sounds like a dictator.
Yeah.
So the other ruthless thing that he does comes during the conquering of Egypt, I suppose. So,
well, it's kind of part of the fallout of that, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So he kills Caesarion, who is, depending if you believe it, Caesar and Cleopatra's child, who's about 18 at the time,
and just a teenager,
a threat just by his lineage. He kills Antony's son, Attalus.
Antyllus.
There we go. First correction. Ah, 41 minutes in. First correction. Kills Antony's son and takes Cleopatra and Antony's children and puts them in his triumph. So, like, these are captives that I'm lording it over.
Yeah, because
in my very long triple triumph, right behind the 79 golden camels.
Well, I think the idea is that if he couldn't get Cleopatra, then he'll have them instead.
Yeah.
To not end completely with his cruelty, he apparently had the children of Antony and Cleopatra taken care of, and he got his sister Octavia, Antony's spurned wife, to do that.
Mm.
Which and I can never quite get over that she was prepared to accept it, but apparently she did, and the daughters were sort of well married off in that way.
The daughter was well married off and the sons were never heard from again.
Yeah, you're very suspicious of
that,
aren't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Sure, they're buried in a wall somewhere. And on that note. But he does, coming back to the sacking of Rome, and this is kind of a reflection on the way that things will go when he becomes an emperor, take all the spoils of war and turns it into good things.
Well, yes. I mean, he's what he does and what he's very famous for and what he tells us about at great length in the achievements of the divine Augustus is he builds a lot in Rome. He has buildings rebuilt. He has buildings restored. He has new temples built. And there are big, long lists of this if you read the achievements of the divine Augustus. Just, I restored this temple and that temple and this basilica. And that, and then he says, and I didn't put my own name on them. I kept the original name. I didn't get any credit for it, except this big bit of credit that I'm getting here by having this plastered outside my mausoleum, which, by the way, is another building that I had built very quickly when I got back to Rome. It's a huge drum mausoleum by the banks of the Tiber for the Julian family. So he makes a big stamp on Rome. But I guess that's one of the things that has been seen as his great achievement that he brags about, and Suetonius also tells us is one of his great achievements, that he made this physical mark on Rome and he made it much grander than it had been.
Don't look at me. I can't find my Suetonius quote.
Okay. Well, Suetonius, this is the famous quote about Augustus, says, since the city was not adorned as the dignity of the empire demanded... So in other words, Rome really looked a mess. It didn't look like a city that controlled a huge empire. And it was exposed to flood and fire. Well, you had a lot of fires, so that's ongoing. He, Augustus, so beautified it that he could justly boast that he had found it built of brick and left it in marble.
It's a good quote, that one, and we've had it as our podcast description for 6 years now.
Oh, really? Oh, yes, we have, haven't we? Yeah, and it's kind of succinct. It says a lot about his achievement in Rome. And, of course, it's about Rome. And remember, one of his big propaganda moves against Antony is to say, what if Antony just carries it all off to Alexandria? Mm. Whereas I'm investing in Rome. I'm giving you your home and making it better. I'm staying here. I won't be going off to Egypt and running away. So he's really saying an awful lot in that. It's not just about the beautification of the city. There's a whole ideology behind it.
So to finish us off then, this isn't in here. Do you think that Augustus earned the title that he had? Do you think that he was good at what he was doing, or do you think he was lucky?
So do you think he earned the title Augustus, one?
Yeah, becoming emperor. Do you think he was worthy of becoming emperor? Do you think it was... all lucky and all down to a horse falling off the roof at the right time.
I think he was very, very clever. I think that he was extremely pragmatic. I'm going to use that word again.
Yeah.
I think that there was a lot of luck in it. And in a way, he learned from the mistakes of Julius Caesar. So he didn't present himself as a dictator. He didn't represent himself as an emperor. Like, he never uses a word that we could translate as that. He becomes the princeps, the first man, but that's a good old Republican role. It's meant to be the oldest person in the Senate. He isn't, but we can smooth over that.
Mm.
So in a way, he's the cleverest person, so he does deserve it because he manages to make it look, to enough people at least, like he is restoring the Republic. And that he actually says that in the achievements of Augustus. He says, I handed back to the Republic to the Senate, and in exchange they gave me the name Augustus.
Yeah, right.
Very so he deserves done. It because he's good at propaganda. That's my answer.
All right, we've got a few minutes left, so we thought we'd take some questions from the audience, either about Augustus or the podcast, if you have any burning questions. So,
or you can ask Matt about Asterix.
Yes. Good, read this one. So if we could maybe have some room lights, and we've got a roving mic, so hands up, and if you want to introduce yourself and give us a brief question, no soliloquies.
Hi, my name's Andrea. I've kind of got a couple of thoughts or questions. One is, was there really no record of people trying to get rid of Augustus? Like, you know, it seems kind of unbelievable he had such a long reign and there's no record of, you know, people trying to get rid of him, when obviously there were lots of people trying to get rid of other emperors. And also, it also seems really strange that presumably Mark Antony was a great soldier, he was Caesar's right-hand man, and suddenly he just seems to stuff it up and not know what he's doing. What happened there? So, yeah.
Yeah, they're both good questions. We do know of some conspiracies against Augustus. They get snuffed out very quickly. I think part of his luck is also to be the first, because when we get onto the other emperors, it's sort of clear that it's become a system by then. And even though Augustus lasts as princeps for 40 years, there's still this idea that there's a newness about it and he is just creating stability, or what he calls stability. I mean, there is no more civil war. And in Italy, a lot of people be grateful for that. That it might be a transitional period. They're just happy for peace in a way. So I think that when we get, I mean, the second emperor after that is murdered, so it doesn't take long. But it's become clear that it's looking like a system then. And if you want to get rid of that system, or you just want some kind of change of power, you can't vote it out anymore, or you can't vote for a new consul at the beginning of the new year, you've got to get rid of this man, and he's quite young, Caligula, so it's going to take a long time to get somebody else. So I think there's context, and there's also luck and being very vigilant, because he has his ears open. He will exile you if you look like trouble, or just get rid of you. So it is partly efficiency and partly luck.
And I mean, speaking of exile, he's very careful to keep hold of his reputation as well, which is why he kind of gets rid of his family members
when they
become inconvenient.
Part of the propaganda is that he's the restorer of morals, and when his daughter and granddaughter don't match up to that, he carries out the punishment that is meant to be carried out for adultery under his own laws. That's pretty ruthless too, you could argue. As for Antony, I don't know if I have a good answer to that. I mean, I think one of the answers that was given in antiquity and that some ancient historians have repeated, but probably wouldn't anymore, is that he's under the sway of Cleopatra, therefore he's just not thinking straight. But I just think that sounds like nonsense, doesn't it? I mean, he's serious about wanting this empire and wanting to have this empire for himself, as serious as Octavian is. I don't know why he fails at Actium.
Was he taking Egyptian troops into battle at the Battle of Actium, or were they Roman troops?
There were Egyptian troops there, yes. You think they're not as good?
No. But there could be a level of unfamiliarity with command decisions and everything.
That
could be an issue as well, because they've said that was an issue.
It's all speculation.
Yeah,
right?
I know.
Speculation, and it's a huge part of the problem, and I'm sorry, this sounds like a pat answer, I know, is that our sources are so hostile to Antony by and large that it's very hard to take it seriously what is said about him. And that is a result of, again, I come back to it, Augustus's brilliant coup in propaganda terms, in that he wrote that narrative so that Antony was this kind of indolent, always hanging around on an Egyptian barge and drinking too much wine and getting drunk with Cleopatra. No wonder they weren't up to battle. But we've got a whole history of Western art, that we've got a painting in National Gallery of Victoria that shows Antony and Cleopatra lounging around at a banquet, that has kind of fed into this. But to a certain extent, and I really am not a war historian, but I get the impression that some of it is luck and making the right decision at the right time. And they made the wrong decision, from what we're told.
Hi, I'm Cynthia.
Hello.
Hi. It seems that Agrippa was key to Augustus's success. Do we know enough about him for a podcast episode?
Oh, we should do that. That would be lovely.
Do we know enough? Or can you talk more about him now?
I don't know. Then we might not get the episode. well,
we have a long list of episodes.
We do.
Need to do at some point.
I can talk a little bit about him now, and we can certainly talk more later. We don't know as much as we'd like, really, until he becomes part of that band with Octavian, with Augustus. But there is a lot of aftermath. Like, we know that Augustus is clearly very grateful to him because he marries Julia to Agrippa. He marries his only daughter, his only legitimate offspring. And indeed, his five grandchildren are the children of Julia and Agrippa, the ones that his whole succession depends on, and it fails because they all die or disappoint him in some way. Mm. But yes, Agrippa is brought into the Julian family. So clearly he feels he owes him a lot. Some people think that Agrippa felt, even though he'd married Julia, that he was being marginalized in a way because he thought that he might be named as the successor himself rather than his children. He's not really the right age for that, so it's sort of strange.
I think we've kind of proved that age doesn't mean anything in this time.
I guess.
And I mean, in those early days, you know, succession could be what you made it. Oh, right.
in all likelihood.
Yeah.
And Augustus is looking to the next generation, and in his case, two generations on. So he's very important from that point of view, and he could have been, and if Octavian had had his way, he should have been the father of the next emperor. It's just that Augustus's adopted sons, his two grandsons, die before him.
So Agrippa podcast?
Oh, yeah.
2020?
Agrippa cast. I put him for a year on it.
Did he make the Pantheon?
Yes.
Ah!
Marcus Agrippa.
Got something right. Marcus Agrippa was here. That's right.
He made it in his third consulship.
Yeah.
Yeah, and restored by Hadrian.
Who didn't put his own name on it. And later restored by Septimius Severus, who did.
See, Hadrian's taking a leaf out of Augustus' book. Septimius Severus hasn't learned that lesson.
Ah, good times. All right. I can see one right at the back there in the middle.
Thanks. Just two very quick ones. Who was the first emperor to actually use that word emperor to describe himself? And what did happen to poor Brutus's head?
Oh, we didn't talk about it.
Oh,
how
okay.
Bad is that?
Poor Brutus's head was thrown at the feet of the statue of Julius Caesar in the Forum as kind of a here you go, avenged. But I also found reference to him being cremated.
Well, that was the rest of him.
That was the rest of him. So, look, worse things have happened to traitors. Yeah,
they usually get thrown into the Tiber and dragged along on hooks and things.
Yeah.
There's a whole kind of narrative of things that happen around statues, isn't there? Because Julius Caesar gets murdered in the theatre of Pompey and lies dead beneath the statue of Pompey, his great Civil War enemy.
Mm.
So you can see a lot of symbolism in that. And so it's important to Octavian that Brutus gets symbolically kind of humbled in this way. So that's what happens to his head.
So a bit right back at you.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like we built that up too much now, and there wasn't a shock value because it's really nasty.
The other question was who first used this emperor as a title? Do you reckon that was Tiberius?
Well, this is difficult because we get the word emperor from the Latin word imperator, which kind of means general. So it has been used before. I was a bit disingenuous when I said that.
Mm.
So imperator is a title that will be given to a general in charge of an army in battle. And certainly when he's triumphing, he is the triumphing imperator. But it's a title that sort of gets added to every princeps's, or emperors we call them, name. So they're all imperator. They just have charge over the army. So I guess it's a question that ancient historians argue about a little bit, which is the first emperor to regard himself and be regarded by the people as an emperor, because it's a term that sort of comes along later. In other words, there's no chance of going back to the Republic now. And you might say that it's the next emperor, Tiberius, because we've had a succession. It wasn't just this blip. All right, it wasn't just Augustus bringing peace and now we can go back to the Senate. Some people would say it's later, that it's when Nero dies and we get another dynasty. It's like it's not even just this family now. It's a whole load of civil wars to see who'll be in charge. So I think my money's sort of on Tiberius, but it is a matter of interpretation, which is a terrible academic answer to that question. You just want a name. And in a way, Tiberius is a really bad example because, of course, he doesn't seem to really want it, does he? He just... if you've listened to the podcast or you might have read elsewhere, he just goes off into self-imposed exile and has a nice time on Capri. But so maybe it's Caligula.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
I'll just go through them
all.
Yeah.
I'll just stop you there before you go, maybe it's this person, maybe it's that person. We had a question up here.
Thank you. I'm wanting a comment more. One of the problems with Augustus, it seems to me, is that we look at him with hindsight, as you've acknowledged. But he, of course, was living his life in a forward direction and didn't know how it was going to turn out. And one of the problems with Augustus is that he nearly dies three times that he documents. So a lot of the problems with him, I think, are that we see him as making plans or being... he's obviously pragmatic at the time, but he's not really making sort of long-term plans because he didn't even know that he was going to necessarily survive, you know, when he's doing all these trips around and he's lying with what might have been malaria or something else. So do you comment on that?
Yeah, I think you're right that, you know, we see it as a whole life and he's making contingent plans quite often, which is one of the reasons he's so desperate to establish the succession. So that he has an heir in the way that he was Julius Caesar's heir. There is somebody to continue this power grab in a way and to continue the Julian line. So I think you're quite right about that. And I think it's reflected also in what we've discussed with his early life that it works out, but I do think there's a certain amount of luck there. So as I say, quite often it's a kind of scrabbling around for what's going to work now. Who do I have to make an allegiance with to get through this stage? I think it's the fact that he has no problem with breaking those allegiances later that actually works for him. It's kind of sad because it's sort of a story of use these people and move on, and that's successful in this case. So I take your point absolutely, that we make it sound like this was a big plan and he knew he was going to live into his 70s, and that's so far from the truth. He really didn't know that. And that explains some of his behaviour early on with trying to establish the succession. And also trying to establish himself, because by the time he becomes what we would call emperor, and he gets the name Augustus, things look certain, but they're not. There's another settlement a few years later. All right, so those early years are sort of working it all out. So in the 20s BCE, I think there's still a lot of doubt about how long this can last, and is it really something that's sustainable? Is it something we even want to sustain? I mean, he has his critics.
And there's also a gradual power grab.
So at the beginning, you know, he kind of has authority, and the name Augustus means authority, almost literally, but he doesn't technically have any power. And then he gets, and this is something I sort of referred to in an offhand way, he gets tribunician power, which is the power of the veto, which he has all of the time. He's not really meant to have that tribunician position as a patrician, so that's a bit of a fudge, all right? That's only meant to go to the plebs. And that's a great power. And every emperor after that will get that power. And that means you can't do anything without this man vetoing you. You can't bring any law forward. You can't pass anything. You can't make any decrees. If he doesn't want it, it's gone.
Some people misuse vetoes, don't they?
They do. It is quite possible. Should we be looking at time?
Yeah,
is time
yeah,
up for Augustus?
I was going to wind you up.
Yeah. No, okay. Please do wind me up.
Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Dr. Rhiannon Evans. And that's it today for our live show. So thank you all for coming tonight. I'm Matt Smith. You have all been very fantastic. And thanks for listening.
Thank you so much. Well, later.